Okay, the title of my talk is Classical Nova Rates and Properties. And let me give a brief outline before I start. First, I'll talk about extragalactic nova rates and about a dozen galaxies for which we have nova rates at this point. And then I'll move on to a discussion of the galactic nova rate, which you can estimate based on the galactic surveys doing a scaling. And it turns out that's actually one of the best ways that you can estimate the galactic nova rate, because it's difficult to determine directly because of all the extinction that you find in the galaxy. Next, I'll talk about nova properties, and in particular, population differences between different types of novae. Also talk about spectroscopic classes of novae, which is a topic that may be new to a lot of you, and what they can tell us about nova population differences. Finally, I will talk, despite what Sumner said, a little bit about recurrent novae in M31, the population of recurrent novae, and whether or not they can be a significant progenitor of type 1a supernovae. This plot shows the luminosity-specific nova rates for novae that we know about so far. There have been about a dozen galaxies that have been studied. And if you neglect for the moment the LMC and the SMC here, you notice that the luminosity-specific nova rate, which is measured in terms of the number of novae per year per 10 to the 10 solar luminosities in the K-band, plotted against galaxy color with the late-type galaxies on the left here and the earlier-type galaxies, including a lot of giant elliptical galaxies in Virgo on the right, what you notice is that the luminosity-specific nova rate is relatively constant at a value of about 2.2 per year for 10 to the 10 solar luminosities in K. There's a couple of other points that I've shown here. This point is from work done by Mike Shara with space telescope data, actually archival space telescope data. And he estimated a nova rate for that galaxy of about 300 a year, which is about a factor of 3 higher than the ground-based estimates that I did over here and other people have done. So this point is somewhat uncertain. This work has not been published yet. It was presented at a conference, so I'm not quite sure how seriously to take this point. But nevertheless, it's quite interesting that it is up at the same level as the SMC and the LMC over here. There's another galaxy, NGC 2403, which I'm currently working on with this student, Rose Matheny, and this is still preliminary data, so we don't have good numbers for it yet, but it looks as though its nova rate, luminosity-specific nova rate, may be quite high as well. So again, at this point, things are still in a state of flux, but what I would say is that there's no strong evidence that the luminosity-specific nova rate varies strongly with Hubble type as you go across from late-type galaxies to early-type galaxies. That could change. There's some theoretical work done by Tutikoff and Jungelson and others that have argued that maybe late-type galaxies should be more prolific nova producers because the active nova systems in those galaxies should contain, on average, more massive white dwarfs. Here's another way of looking at that data. This is the nova rate versus the integrated galaxy K-band luminosity, and this kind of plot, of course, is a nice linear correlation. This kind of plot is actually quite useful if you want to try to estimate nova rates in galaxies that haven't been surveyed. You can also use it to estimate the galactic nova rate, and if you do that, if you plug in the luminosity of the Milky Way, you find a galactic nova rate of about 28 a year. This number is in pretty good agreement with what you get if you try to do the galactic nova rate directly by looking at the local nova rate out to a limiting magnitude of about second magnitude, which corresponds to a distance from the sun of about 3/4 of a kiloparsec. So if you assume that nova rate is well known over the past century or so, and then you extrapolate that to the rest of the galaxy using a galaxy model like the Bacall-Sonera model, for example, you end up with a nova rate of about 35 per year, which is in good agreement with this value. So I think a nova rate for the galaxy of about 30 a year seems to make sense. If you want to talk about nova properties and possible differences between different populations, the best place to start is to look at M31. It's been the principal target for most surveys over the past century. What I've listed here are a few of the major surveys that have been done over that time, and about half of the total of about 800 nova systems that have been discovered in M31 have been discovered in these major surveys, the other half in more minor surveys, and also due to the increasing contribution of amateurs now that are watching the galaxy on a very frequent basis with their 16-inch telescopes. I should point out that of these 800, a fair number of them could be, or at least a significant number of them, could actually not be novae, but could be long-period Mira variables that are masquerading as novae. We've recently discovered a few such systems, but you pretty much need spectroscopic observations in order to do that. And the number of novae with spectroscopic observations in M31 has increased a lot in recent years, and I'll talk more about that later. What are the principal conclusions of all these surveys? First of all, the nova rate was thought for many years to be on the order of 30 or 40 per year in this galaxy. You have to make a lot of corrections for incompleteness and so forth, and that's kind of difficult to do, so you're really bumping up the observed rate quite a bit when you correct for that. There's been a recent survey by Matt Darnley, Mike Bode, using the Point Agape data, and they would argue that the nova rate is actually as high as 65 a year. And this is just based upon their analysis for completeness, and they would argue that a lot of the earlier surveys have overestimated the completeness, so they get a higher rate. One of the conclusions that most of these groups that have worked on M31 agree on is that, somewhat surprisingly, novae appear consistent with the main bulge population. And the evidence for that is shown here. If you take the radial distribution of novae, the isofoetal radius of novae in a survey, in this case that I did back about 10 years ago, and compare that with the background integrated light, the cumulative distribution of background integrated light, you see here that the nova distribution, the radial distribution, falls off more quickly than the background B light for that galaxy. And the right panel here, you see that the nova cumulative distribution falls off a little bit more slowly, and not too bad agreement with the background R light, but the background R light is actually dominated by the bulge of the galaxy. If you take it a step further and you do a bulge disk decomposition for M31, separating the bulge light from the disk light, assuming a de Vaucouleurs law for the bulge and exponential for the disk, what you find is that the nova distribution in M31 follows the bulge light very, very well, and it doesn't follow the disk light at all. This work has also been corroborated by other studies, including the Darnley et al. Study that I mentioned before. And so this is, as I said, quite an enticing discovery. And the question is it real? One question that you might be worried about is whether or not the nova distribution in the disk is suppressed because of extinction relative to the bulge. So the fact that the novae appear to follow the bulge could just be an artifact of that. One way to sort of do a check on that is to compare the nova distribution with the planetary nebula distribution in the galaxy. Planetary nebulae are typically discovered by their 5007 emission, and the 5007 emission should be at least, if not more, affected by extinction than the novae, because the novae in my survey that is shown here were observed and detected by their H-alpha emission. So again, reproduce the nova follow the bulge light. They don't follow the B light so well. The planetary nebulae don't follow the bulge light, but follow the background B light very well. And since the planetary nebula distribution should not be strongly influenced by stellar population, the stellar death rate is pretty much insensitive to stellar population for populations older than about a giga-year or so, at a rate of about 2 × 10⁻¹ⁱ stars per solar luminosity. in that per year in a galaxy independent of stellar population. So I think this adds something to the idea that maybe this is a real result. If you think about why it is that the bulge population is so high, it could be that there's a different formation mechanism involved with bulge novae compared to disk novae. And this goes back to the idea that perhaps in addition to the normal common envelope evolution that leads to the formation of cataclysmic variable stars of which novae are a group, it could be that you're also forming novae in stellar encounters, say in globular clusters in large numbers. There have been several novae that have been discovered actually in globular clusters. Perhaps their rate is much higher than it is in the field per unit luminosity. Some tantalizing evidence for this is provided by the observation that Mike Shara had for M87, that 300 novae per year. If that turns out to be right, that's quite interesting, because there are two dominant ellipticals in Virgo, M87 and M49. Both have measured nova rates. If you take the 300 nova per year in M87, and you compare it with the nova rate in M49, also determined by Space Telescope data by Ferraresi et al., which is at a value of about 100 per year, you notice that the ratio is about a factor of 3. In the sense, M87 produces about 3 times as many novae as M49, even though M49 is the more luminous galaxy. But the globular cluster rate, globular cluster population, I should say, in M87 is about 3 times as high as it is in M49. So that's just, you know, an interesting coincidence, or maybe it's actually telling us something. What about the idea that there are two distinct populations of novae, perhaps disk novae and bulge novae? If you look at the maximum magnitude distribution from ARP's sample of novae, this is one of the major surveys done in the 1950s as part of ARP's dissertation, you notice that it's bimodal. You have one group here with an absolute magnitude peak at around -8.5, and another one over here at about -7. If that's real, perhaps these are representing, say, disk novae, and those are bulge novae. It turns out that's probably not the case. Other surveys done more recently have shown that the distributions of maximum magnitude, certainly in the Darnley et al. Survey, are not bimodal. But you can also test this idea by looking at the spatial distribution of novae of different speed classes. So, for example, here on this plot, plotted as red points, I show novae in M31 from the Hubble-Arp-Rosino sample that have fade rates that take the nova longer than 12 days to decline by 2 magnitudes. That's a common way of measuring the fade rate of novae, is how far they decay, how long it takes them to decay by 2 magnitudes. If you look at novae that decay by 2 magnitudes in less than 12 days, those are the blue points here, so those are the fast novae. You don't really see here, obviously, any segregation between bulge and, say, disk. If you compare the isophotal radius distributions for the fast novae in blue and the slow novae in red, again, there's no obvious evidence, and that's also shown here by the cumulative distribution. Maybe it's the case that the fast novae are slightly more extended, but there's certainly no obvious effect here. So I'm a bit skeptical about that. Another approach to studying nova populations is to look at the spectral classification of novae. And this is an idea that goes back to Williams back in the early 1990s, who noticed that galactic novae can be naturally divided up into two groups, so-called iron II novae, which have sharp emission lines, relatively speaking, P-Cygni profiles indicating that you have an expanding optically thick wind. These novae tend to evolve more slowly, have lower excitation. And then the other group, which represents about 15% of the total, are the helium nitrogen systems with much broader lines, no iron II lines at all in these. I'll talk a little bit later about what could be causing that. Okay, what about their radial dependence? Again, no effect. Blue points are the helium nitrogen novae. Red points are the iron II, the more common iron II. Again, there's no real evidence for any spatial segregation in M31 in those cases. A lot of this data has come from a survey that I'm working on with the HET where we basically more than doubled the total number of spectra for novae that are available in that galaxy. Okay, what about in the galaxy? I extended the work done about a decade ago by De La Valle and Livio by going back through all of the galactic data that are available trying to determine spectroscopic classifications for novae in our galaxy. And there are about 94 for which I was able to do that. What's plotted here is the expansion rate for Wolf half max based on the width of the emission lines versus the fade rate. And you can see for iron 2 novae, they're pretty much down here in this lower left-hand part of the diagram. They fade relatively slowly. They don't have very wide emission lines. If you put the iron 2 systems on the same plot, you notice, or sorry, the helium nitrogen ones on the same plot, you notice that they are clearly have broader lines and decay much more quickly. The question is, why is that? Well, to answer that question, you need to go back to the plot that that Dean showed a little bit ago from his paper with Lars Bilsen back in 2005, and this basically shows the ignition masses for novae depend not only on the mass of the white dwarf, which had been previously assumed, but also on the temperature of the white dwarf and hence on the accretion rate. So, for example, what are the predictions here? If you assume a particular mass accretion rate, what you find is that the higher the mass of the white dwarf, the less material you have to accrete to get a thermonuclear runaway. And so then you could argue that, well, those systems that finally do go novae are going to eject shell masses that are less than systems that have to accrete more material. So a prediction is that high mass white dwarf systems should produce lower mass shells. Well, it's difficult to test that prediction because there aren't very many good estimates for nova shell masses in the literature. It's a difficult measurement to make, and there certainly aren't very many nova white dwarf masses that have been estimated either because it's difficult to make those measurements. So what I've done here is I've used neon novae as a proxy for mass, and I've assumed that the neon novae are more massive, have white dwarfs that are more massive than the carbon oxygen ones, and plotted the ejected mass versus the fade rate and emission line full of half max here. And you can see, contrary to what you might expect, the oxygen and magnesium white dwarfs, which should be more massive, are actually producing shells that are more massive. So that goes against what you might expect. Finally, let me just quickly talk about the recurrent nova population, as a couple of people have mentioned earlier. Wolfgang Pietsch has compiled a list of about 800 of novae and nova candidates in M31. They all have good spatial positions for them. And what you want to do if you want to find recurrent novae is you want to look for spatial coincidences, right? But all the coordinates aren't going to be exact, and so you have to allow an error circle. I've arbitrarily adopted 5 arc seconds. The results aren't too sensitive to that. What you find is there are a total of 23 pairs, 3 triples, and 1 quad. That's where you have 4 novae, or 4 nova outbursts, all within 5 arc seconds. So of those 27 recurrent nova candidates, and I use that kind of loosely, many of them are going to be chance positional coincidences, especially down near the center. To estimate what fraction, we've basically done a Monte Carlo simulation, and that's shown here. And for a 5 arc second separation, you expect about 20 of them, almost all of them, to be chance coincidences, with a 6% chance that all of them, in fact, could be chance coincidences. So if you take the optimistic view and say that, you know, maybe 7 of them are real recurrent novae, that would be 14 outbursts out of 814 systems for which we have positions, then that gives you a raw ratio of recurrent nova outbursts to classical nova outbursts of 0.018. But the problem here is that the discovery efficiency for recurrent novae is, of course, much suppressed for classical novae because you have to discover them twice. And their light curves are faster. And so we've done another Monte Carlo simulation to try to estimate the recurrent nova discovery efficiency compared to classical novae, and we find that it's about 9%. So if you correct this number for 9%, you find the correct ratio of recurrent novae outbursts to classical novae outbursts is 0.2, which means that 1 in 6 novae going off in M31 could actually be a recurrent nova outburst. Final thing I'll say is that if you adopt the parameters for the galactic novae, the recurrence time of about 30 a year assume they start with a white dwarf mass on average of about 1.3 solar masses, and they accreted about 10 to the minus 7 solar masses a year, which seems to be true for the galactic novae, what you find is, you fold all these numbers in, you get a recurrent nova death rate in M31 of about 3 times 10 to the minus 4 per year, and this is kind of an optimistic view. But that would be maybe 10%, if you're lucky, of the type 1a supernova birth rate. So a lot of uncertainties in this, but I think it's probably the case that some recurrent novae are going to end up as type 1a supernovae. They're not going to explain all of them, but they might be able to explain a significant fraction of them. And I'll just conclude by leaving this up.
Start by asking, so one distinction that's occurring quite often in the neon novae is that some of that neon quite often is just the neon 22 at a 2% mass fraction, and some of those get called neon novae, even though it's probably on a carbon oxygen white dwarf. So for those neon novae you show, do they have neon mass fractions high, 5% or above?
I just compiled a list of all the objects that have been called in the literature neon novae, so I didn't actually look to that level.
That high data point for M87 that you pointed out on
yes.
the first slide and then talked about later seems quite intriguing. How many, you know, with ground-based observations, could there be a lot of novae that are being missed in, you know, many of these points?
That's certainly possible. Let me put that back up. That's one of the things we worry about, because you have to correct for, depending on how frequently you survey, you have to correct for how long novae remain brighter than a certain limiting magnitude and so forth. And so if you could have, you know, a dedicated telescope with continuous monitoring, that would really help a lot. To answer your question, I think it's certainly likely that these points could be raised a bit. By a factor of 3, though, I think that's unlikely.
Alan, you made a comment about the oxygen neon novae are ejecting more material than the CO novae. We've found, or we being Bob Garrett's Chick Woodward and I have been looking at that ourselves, and we completely agree with you, and that certainly flies in the face of all of our theoretical calculations. We don't understand that result.
Right.
Yeah, I just wondered about, you mentioned globular clusters as another
right.
potential factory for these things. So, and you mentioned briefly about the ones that novae have been found, the galactic ones. So as far as I know, there's two, right?
That's right.
So I wondered whether you have, does that give you any interesting constraints if you compare that to what we were saying about the extragalactic rates?
It's real small number statistics. Yeah, there are two. There's one, I think, T-SCO, and another one in 1938 in some GC cluster. There's also been one discovered in M87 by Mike Shara, and another one just recently by Robert Quimby and myself in M31. So if you try to do statistics on that, what you find is it looks like that the nova rate may slightly be enhanced per unit mass in clusters based on those four observations, but not by a lot, say, over the field. But again, small number statistics, and novae are hard to find in globular clusters, right? Because, you know, they're roughly, you know, average Galbraith cluster might have a, you know, absolute magnitude of about minus 8 or so, and that's typical of a nova. So they're not going to be very conspicuous. So we could have missed a lot of them. Sheree?
Have you looked into the specific incidence anomalies the same way of LMXBs in M87 versus these other galaxies? Because in our own galaxy, the LMXBs are enhanced in the bulge.
Sure, right. I haven't done that in M87.
Yeah, that might be the next useful, totally empirical thing where
right.
the size of the galaxy doesn't come in at all.
Hi, Alan. Yes. Are there any useful constraints on the nova rate in galactic globular clusters?
No, I think that was related to an earlier question. Basically, in galactic globular clusters, there have been two nova outbursts that have been recorded. And as far as I recall, the number of CVs, white dwarf accretors in globular clusters, at first was surprisingly low relative to what you might expect. But I think that number has been growing recently. and now they may be enhanced in the library clusters, but I'm not sure about that. This NOVA systems, or cataclysmic variable systems, not actual NOVA outbursts.
Okay, so let's thank all the speakers from this morning. So just to remind everybody, lunch is that way. We've got an hour and a half, which gives you plenty of time to see the posters, which are on this side. And Jocelyn, do I need to alert people to any administrative things? No. The people that know, you know who you are. Yeah.